The other thing about positive and political statements, being able to embrace those positive statements is a political act for a lot of people, because it's a way of saying, no, I'm allowed to be content with my existence, regardless of the ways that I'm being put down or being suppressed. Daring to hope and daring to really cling to those messages, I think, is a political act. And because of that, I seek out specifically positive statements while accepting that the world is a difficult place for a lot of people, and balancing an understanding of that, but also rejecting that it always has to be true and that we can't do better.
Hi, I'm Daphne Cohn. Welcome to the Creativity Habit Podcast, conversations with the artists and makers who use creativity to innovate, disrupt, and elevate. Grace Chin makes art that is both political and pretty, useful and ornamental. She makes beautiful wreaths that surround strong personal and political statements. Statements like, smash the patriarchy, hope fiercely, nevertheless, she persisted, I believe you, and take care. Grace graduated with a BFA in printmaking from the University of Kansas in 2012. Before starting her career as a full-time artist, she worked for a while at a toy store until she decided that she wanted to pay her rent doing what she loved. Grace went on to do just that, building an Instagram community of over 20,000 and supporting herself from her craft. In this interview, we talk about her story from making art, to studying art, to leaving art, to making it again as a full-time gig. We also dive into how she marries her feminist politics with the craft of wreath making, how to make art when you're feeling stuck, the dance between hope and resistance, fighting and joy, using creativity to imagine a better world and using art to change it, and how you never have to compromise who you are to do what you want to do. May you enjoy this conversation, and may it inspire you to make your thing and change your world. Welcome, Grace, to the Creativity Habit Podcast.
Thanks for having me here, Daphne. I'm really excited.
I start every interview with your creativity story, how creativity showed up for you as a young girl. And creativity is a pretty broad, I use it pretty broadly. So Whatever that looks like for you and how it showed up for you when you were little.
I mean, it was definitely mostly because my mother, she is an artist. And when she came to the States, both she and my father were students. So she had to get pretty creative with what they had because they were student loan debt and working things out. So my parents, especially my mother, had to be creative with keeping us entertained and engaged. Art has just been part of my life since then because of that.
Where did your parents come from?
They immigrated from South Korea in 1987, so 2 years before I was born.
Was South Korean culture and heritage a big part of your childhood?
Oh, definitely. For the first 10 years of my life, we lived in Southern California, where there's a really strong Korean-American community. And though we lived a few other places, by the time I was in my teens, we moved to Kansas, which was kind of a culture shock and completely the opposite of my experience in Southern California. But yes, it's definitely a big part.
The change from being in Southern California to Kansas and being in a place that had a strong South Korean culture to one that did not have a stronger one, do you think that influenced your art later on? Do you see a connection there?
Oh, yeah, I think so. We moved to a few other places, but it was interesting for me to get kind of a sampling of a lot of different Americas, quote unquote. And I think it really changed my worldview to be in both a really blue state and then to be in a really red state.
Okay, we'll get into that because I know it's a big piece of your art. So we'll start with, before I go into your art, with intersectional feminism, because it's in your bio and it says that your work, you say your work is inextricably tied to your passion for intersectional feminism. So I want to begin by having you actually just explain what intersectional feminism means, because in some ways it's an old term, but it's also a relatively new term.
Yeah, I can't remember what year, but the term was coined by Stuart Hall in the 80s, I want to say. It's the concept that a person can have multiple identities and multiple ways of experiencing the world. That includes race, sexual orientation, and class, education. All those things contribute to who a person is and how they experience the world, and that converges with their feminism.
And what was it in either in your growing up or just in where you're at, what was it that had feminism and intersectional feminism, attention to race and gender and sexual orientation, what had that play such a central role in who you are now?
I think my understanding of that concept, like without the terminology, came pretty early because, like I mentioned, I grew up on a college campus while my parents were finishing up their advanced degrees. We lived in an area that was full of other immigrant children, you know. It was kind of like a Tower of Babel situation where none of us spoke the same language, but it was comfortable. And all of a sudden, when I went to school, no one was speaking Korean, and I didn't understand that. And I think because of that experience, it gave me an understanding that there are a lot of different ways of seeing the world. It gave me a lot of empathy and a lot of ability from a young age to understand that there's no one set way of seeing the world.
So you said when you went to school, other kids weren't speaking Korean and you didn't understand that.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't understand it in the sense that because of where you'd come from, where there were so many different languages and that was the norm?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Like, because I was expected to speak English, which did happen pretty quickly because at that point, your brain is really squishy and will adapt to a lot of different situations. But yes, because at home, I did speak a little bit of English, and there's kind of a weird in-between ground that still exists for me and my parents, where we speak a unique blend of Korean and English. But it was so difficult for me. It just felt really frustrating because I'd grown up around adults that spoke Korean and understood me. And all of a sudden, I was put in a situation where I was like, why don't they get what I'm saying? I'm saying this exactly the same way I said this to other adults. And I think that was part of also my first understanding of race and national identity.
And where did art play into this for you at this point? Were you making art? Was art a place that you went to for understanding, or was it not part of your life at this time?
Oh, it definitely was. My mother was also teaching art classes, and I got to participate in them. So I was doing a lot of that, and I think naturally, because of that language barrier, I was seeking ways to find expression without language. I guess the easiest place to do that is visually. I didn't always expect to be an artist, but creativity was just part of what happened in our family.
But then you did go on to school and get a BFA in printmaking. So at what point did you go from, I'm not sure I'm going to be an artist, to I'm going to go to school specifically for art and in particular printmaking?
I began my university education as an art history major because I was definitely interested in art. I just wasn't sure that I wanted to do that. I had taken art classes in high school and been involved in art-related activities, but it was really after diving into art history that I started to realize this is great, but I also want to do this. I'm going to be a graphic designer. And at that point in my program, you had to take foundations courses, and then you also had to take a few art electives before beginning. And I think the choice was between like ceramics and printmaking. And I was like, oh, printmaking, I'll try that. So my first class was intaglio class, which is copper plate etching. And as soon as I got a little taste of it, I wanted more. The history of printmaking and printmaking culture was just so fascinating to me. It was just like, I can't do anything else. I have to do this. That's basically how I got there.
How did printmaking turn into wreath making?
Sorry, that is a great question. I went from graduating from that printmaking program to taking a break for a while. For anyone familiar with printmaking processes, you know that without a press and without access to a shop, it is very hard to continue printmaking on your own. It's definitely a community-based activity, and it requires pooling resources, unless you're super rich, in which case that's really cool. You can get your own press and do stuff. But after I took a break, drawing just became incredibly hard for me. I just could not sit down and draw anything anymore. And I don't know where that block came from. Well, no, I do know where it came from. It came from going from an incredibly supportive community where you're learning and it's being fostered to suddenly being in a non-school setting where I was having to flounder for a while, which I think was actually pretty healthy. And I decided to stop working with drawing, try making a few 3D things, making some really bad 3D things that are not on the internet, and I'm so grateful that they're not. And then I was working for a toy store, funnily enough. One of my responsibilities there was to make window displays, and there was one spring when I was like, I really want to make this kind of Fantasia. I want to do my own interpretation of Alice in Wonderland, and a lot of that involved making things from cardboard, paper mache, and I was like, I really want to make large flowers. So just started making those and really wanted to make a welcome wreath for my home. In undergrad, I'd really wanted to integrate my feminism and my feminist education into what I was doing visually, because my undergraduate education, like a lot of it was becoming a feminist as well and embracing that title or label. When I started making those paper flowers, I was at another moment where I was like, is there a way to do this? Is there a way to marry my feminist politics with this craft that I'm finding myself interested in? There was a way. A lot of that was influenced by a lot of the paper cut artists who were working at the time, who were integrating text into their paper cuts. Seeing that gave me the resources to problem solve and put text in those wreaths.
And so that was really how you tied your feminism into your art, was with the text.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to ask you first something about feminism and then get into the art. So what is it for you that is so important to you around feminism and intersectional feminism?
So I had a friend express it in a way that I really relate to, and it's that I cannot stand being dismissed. That is one of my hot buttons. And I think having that and like understanding that my gender was part of it was a huge part in making me a feminist. So never wanting to be brushed off or not taken seriously or recognized as a person, that all played into it.
And so the follow-up to that is, you said, you know, not being dismissed is really important to you. Is that something that you feel your art also helps do for you, is to give you that voice so you're not dismissed?
Oh yeah, I think all art at some level, whether people like to admit it or not, is a way of saying, look at this, pay attention to this, I really want you to look at this. Giving that to people outside yourself, I think, is a way of saying, hey, please look at this for a minute.
In your wreaths, you have words, some of the words that you have are things like hope does not die, smash the patriarchy, mm-hmm. I believe you, nevertheless she persisted. It's this mixture of political statements and positive statements.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of dance between the two and back and forth. And I wanted to ask you about both of those, because one of the things you say is, I sincerely believe that internalizing and imbibing positive messages are meaningful daily rituals to combat the myriad negative messages we're exposed to. So how do you internalize and imbibe positive messages? How do you have that become part of you so that you can then put it out with your art?
Well, the first way is constantly seeking out new reading material. Reading is a skill that really improves somebody's ability to see outside themselves and to expand, to stretch the limits of their empathy and understanding of other people, and to do that intentionally. The other thing about positive and political statements, being able to embrace those positive statements is a political act for a lot of people, because it's a way of saying, no, I'm allowed to be content with my existence regardless of the ways that I'm being put down or being suppressed. Daring to hope and daring to really cling to those messages, I think, is a political act. And because of that, I seek out specifically positive statements while accepting that the world is a difficult place for a lot of people, and balancing an understanding of that, but also rejecting that it always has to be true and that we can't do better.
Rejecting that the world as it is true.
Refusing to accept that as something that always has to be true. Like seeing the ways historically that we as a society have pushed beyond ways that we've been cruel to other human beings. Seeing that example and knowing that we can do better. Rejecting the notion that the status quo is always going to be the status quo.
Yeah, and I love that you're emphasizing doing that from this place of hope, and you didn't use the word joy, but to do that from a place of that, those are a place of power, that those give you power. That is a political act in and of itself, is to say, yeah, I can be hopeful and I can be content with my life. And that's great. And actually, you had asked this question of your community, and I was really curious what kind of response you got and what you see as the answer. And so this was what you had asked. What's the line between acknowledging the turmoil in the world and depriving yourself of joy? There's a sweet spot somewhere that balances seeing harsh truths about our world, facing that with equanimity, trying hard to change it, and also being a joyful person. I'd love to hear both a little more about what you see as the answer and also what kind of response you got from your community.
I definitely heard from a lot of people expressing that they've struggled to find that line too. And I think that's definitely something that people can define for themselves, because I've had moments in my life where I veered to both extremes. I feel an example that my mother has said. She's someone who sees the ups and downs of the world, has that equanimity, and is very level-headed about it. That's something I admire, because I have so much trouble like calibrating that, keeping somewhat grounded. And it's something that I've tried to improve, I think, in the last few years, which I don't know if that's the result of seeing so many things happen in current events, specifically in the United States, or if it's just a natural part of maturing and seeing the world.
Is being able to be more grounded within it, or which pieces?
Specifically, being able to see the moment that we're in as part of a larger continuum, because I think my mother does a really great job of that. She's able to say, this is hard, acknowledge it, ask, what can I do? What can we do? And seeing isolated as events as, what am I trying to say?
Well, I'll say something, because you have a quote here that says something to that. You say, art is a disruption. Art is seeing opportunities to intervene in the surrounding world and daring to imagine it differently rather than accepting it as it is. So in a lot of ways, this ties in, because it's saying, yes, this is how the world is, and I can see it. I can imagine it differently. And I can use my art to do that.
And it's so funny, because a lot of that way of thinking about art came from learning about street art specifically, because I remember there's a documentary out there called Beautiful Losers, and they have this wonderful quote. I think it might be Aaron Rose who says it. He said something about skateboarding being a way of seeing public spaces and reclaiming them, being able to see space differently. A lot of those people who are skateboarders became artists via street art, and something about being daring enough to interrupt the complacency of the street and realizing that it is a space that people exist in rather than passing through, and causing people to pause, whether it's because they don't like what they see or because they love what they see, and just really wanting so desperately to leave something in that space or change it or alter it, I think is a really brave act.
Well, your art is a brave act, and your art does cause someone to pause, in the sense that you have these really pretty wreaths that you make with these flowers, and they're just really pretty. And then in the middle, you might have words like smash the patriarchy. So there's that juxtaposition between this strong stance about something happening on a political level or just a belief, these words surrounded by this pretty wreath that you make.
Yeah, I think embracing what's seen as a traditionally feminine act and using that vernacular to say something, to say, no, this is art, just because it's useful doesn't mean it's not art. It's a creative act. And growing up, seeing that gave me a broader view of craft as art and not shying away from doing something that people might dismiss as not important or frivolous and seeing it as an opportunity to speak to people.
Yeah. And it's hard to look at your work, though, and see it as frivolous because of the strength of the statement within the piece of art or as part of the piece of art. It's interesting that you just, you know, that you grew up and you learned that, oh, these useful things are art. And one of the things, turning that around, one of the things that you said was, regardless of a maker's intention, art is political once it's available to any audience. So it's both that something useful can be art, and art is always political. And I'm curious how you see art as always being political. And you even talk about it as something as innocuous as a chair. That's the example that I saw with that.
Yeah.
Talk a little more about that. Yeah.
The way people have understood politics, or the way I think some people do think of politics, they think of it as something completely isolated and unrelated to themselves. I don't think that's the prevalent attitude anymore. I do see that attitude expressed sometimes with people telling makers, oh, stop making political statements. You're here to make art. Which just sounds like really circular thinking to me, because anything that somebody does to change the world is a political act, in my opinion. A lot of the decision making that goes into making art and putting it in the world is political in nature. You mentioned the example of the chair. I have an illustration in that particular article that's the Eames chair. At this point, is everywhere. And that was part of the point. It was good design that was meant to be egalitarian. It was meant to be enjoyed for a lot of people, but it was a quality product. And that, for the time, was revolutionary. The other things I talk about are, what materials go into this? How is that material sourced? Were the workers compensated fairly? Who is this made available to, and who can afford it? And where would this be? Seeing art as political comes in part from recognizing that everything comes from somewhere, and the things that we consume come from somewhere and have had multiple lives, and that there's responsibility that comes with experiencing those objects and owning them and producing them.
Yeah, it's also, it's a way of saying that art is a representation of our shared humanity, because you can't extricate a piece of art out of what it was made from or who is part of that piece. And so by seeing all the links between where the art came from, where the materials were sourced, who made those materials, how well they're taken care of, who the art is for, who can afford the art. It's showing the interconnectedness of everything and everyone.
Yeah, and I think that's something we get further and further away from. No, that's not true. That we were taken distance from before. It's like a renewed interest in intentional consumption of food and of clothing specifically as places where we can think about sustainability, but it's harder to think about that in other places and not to be so divorced from the places where those things come from, because those are important things to consider, and we don't exist in a vacuum, especially not with globalization. We're increasingly a part of other people's worlds.
And that ties so much right back into your childhood. Is you experienced globalization as a little girl, and that has impacted you your entire life, big part of your art. So it's interesting to see those connections. Before we move away from this the discussion that's specific to mm-hmm. art and politics and more into art as a business, the steps that you took to get it to where you are today. I want to ask you one last thing, which is in the piece that we just mentioned, which is a piece that you wrote for Design Sponge. You had said, do artists and designers have an obligation to be political? And you wrote, amidst increasingly troubling news, I noticed that more feeds, Instagram feeds and social media, mm-hmm. usually focused on aesthetics. So I noticed that more feeds usually focus on aesthetics were using their platforms to speak out. I felt a sense of solidarity knowing I was in the company of creatives who understood the impact their voices could have. But it also led me to a larger question. Do artists have an obligation to respond to political and social events? What do you think? Do they?
My answer in that article not circumvents that question, but says that question is kind of irrelevant because by existing in a world that is political, their art is political. And I think part of seeing that is being a part of society, politics is the direct result of many humans participating in society and creating society. All of those actions that affect other people, those are political acts. And I think that's a concept that's integral and is sometimes invisible in our world, even though it's there. I really admire the makers who looked around and said, oh, I'm a human who exists in this society. I'm going to take the reins on whatever my creative output is communicating. And I'm going to steer the conversation in a direction I would like it to go.
That leads me to something else that you wrote. Mm-hmm. And I think it's from the same piece. And I ask this both in terms of what we're talking about and also as a business. Art as a business. So that's where we're moving into. And this actually bridges both of the world with politics and with business. Mm-hmm. So you say, in our capitalist consumer-driven economy, the prospect of saying something divisive is daunting to artists whose livelihoods depend on a loyal following. We've been fooled into thinking that artists are beholden to their audience, but the opposite should be true. So the question that I have is, how do we balance not being beholden to our audience while also respecting who they are, what they like of your work, and what they're drawn to and want to buy, if it is your livelihood?
Oof, that's a tangled question because the internet has really changed things for artists, which is a thing people say a lot because it's true. But the idea of an individual artist as a business identity is like a relatively new concept. Being able to just directly sell to people and like selling in some ways, I think it's both a good and bad thing. And I think part of that is, I think artists have been faced with that decision of, okay, I have a patron. Do I want to cater or pander to what they want and have a comfortable living? Or do I want to take the risk of saying what I feel compelled to say and perhaps live a bit of a less stable living? I don't know. That's a decision that I think is individual.
Well, how has obviously it impacted you and your work?
Oh, okay. Me specifically. Well, in a way, I feel obligated to the people who've trusted me with a little bit of their attention and their time to say something important. So the fact that I began with a specifically political and feminist voice and presented that as what is part of my artwork, in a way I feel I should honor that relationship and always say the thing that I think needs to be said, even though it scares me a lot of times.
Okay, let's look at that a little bit then. So even though it scares you, you started by saying, this is who I am. I'm going to express myself, my political views, feminist views. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to shy away from expressing that. And you built up a pretty large community around you. You know, you have an Instagram following of about 21,000, and they're actively engaged. It's not a sleeping community. You know, they're really mm-hmm. part of the community. So what is it then that scares you, being that you've created a community that knows you as this person mm-hmm. and you're sharing views that they're expecting you to be sharing?
So what scares me is, one, the prospect of being wrong, which I've grown a little less afraid of because I have learned that I will probably be wrong a lot of the time. And I can learn, and it's all right. And that fear should never prevent me from trying to say something. Second is a little bit more of like a practical concern, which is that troll culture on the internet is toxic, and a lot of people, like, it can escalate pretty quickly. And there are writers who are producing feminist content who are femme identified who get harassed, and it's reached a point, it's frightening. Luckily, I've avoided a lot of that. Like, I haven't gotten any of that, but that fear is always in the back of my mind.
But so you keep doing it anyway, though, because it's so important to who you are.
Mm-hmm. No, I feel like I'm somehow like cushioned away from that because the community I've built is pretty femme-identified. None of them are trolls. None of them are looking to harm anybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, speaking of this community, how have you built such a large community? I know this is a big question for a lot of people. It's often a question that I have when I look at the communities that people create, is how did you build this actively engaged, really supportive community that's of a fairly substantial size?
I think some of it was luck, because at first I wasn't looking to create a community. I was just looking, I mean, I'll just put it out there. I was looking to pay my rent in a way that didn't involve working in retail while also doing something I loved and felt strongly about and matched my ethos with the way I lived. Like, I was seeing other people doing exactly that, who were building community intentionally and seeking to create an environment where conversations were happening. And I think those examples were really important to me. But a lot of it, I think, also had to do with pretty early on getting exposure from larger outlets that were blogs. And after that, I think right now people are really excited about feminist messages and seeing feminist makers. So I think it just happened at the right time for me. And, you know, there are a lot of people making it possible for that thing to happen.
And did you actively seek out the promotion from those blogs, or did they find you?
No, they found me, which is really cool. I don't think I've ever been good as brand as business sort of thing. Never really reached out to other bloggers, which I don't think is necessarily a good thing, because I've been daunted in the past asking for things that I wanted. And I think that is an attitude that's got to go away, especially for people who are femme-identified. Because, like, a lot of what was keeping me from asking for those things or putting myself out there was the fear of hearing no, or thinking, oh, I don't deserve to get my work profiled here or here or here because they're too big and I'm so small. That actually reminds me specifically of a moment when one of my professors was making a purchase at the toy store, and I think I was wearing like a turkey hat or something ridiculous. She came up to me and was like, look, you said you wanted these things. You said you wanted this internship. You said you wanted to go be an apprentice here. Like, have you applied for any of those things? And I said, no. And she's like, just don't be afraid. The only reason I got any success when I was young was because I didn't know to be afraid. So, like, forget how to be afraid of rejection. Mm. Something about that was, well, one, punctuated by the fact that I was wearing a ridiculous hat, working like a minimum wage job. And, like, I don't know, the significance of that has never left me, even though that's still advice I could use, actually follow up on more often.
I really like forget to be afraid. Like, just forget.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great advice. Does your art at this point pay your rent? Is that your full-time
thing?
Yeah,
it does. Yeah, I do work a few hours at a place called Wonder Fairy Gallery. I've worked there for 7 years. They did a lot to foster my growth as an artist, especially after I graduated. At this point, I'm there just, I want to see my friends who work at Wonder Fair on a regular basis, more than an actual way of paying my rent. Sometimes it's a little scary, though, because when I started this, I did not have like a business plan, which I think was a big mistake, and do not recommend to other artists seeking to make a living solely off their art.
What kind of a business plan would you have had?
any sort of business plan, a business plan. I feel like I've made like every possible mistake in running my own business and being an artist. And I like envision it as like a slalom slope, except I've hit every single flag, but I'm getting to the bottom of the hill, and I'm trying to focus on the fact that I'm getting down and getting to the bottom of the hill, and maybe I'll get through a few of the flags without hitting them.
Okay, so you learned that you should have a business plan. What other major things did you feel like, oh my gosh, I hit that flag? What were some of the big ones?
The hugest one, I think, is not delegating. I've listened to other people give advice and say, if you can afford it, you should delegate. And it wasn't really until this year that I was like, no, I can trust another person to help me pack my artwork and to help me do some more of the administrative tasks. That has been big. I was concerning myself with things that were keeping me back and not letting me get to my larger goals.
And if someone feels like that's great, but they can't afford that, what's your response to that?
I would say part of amending that is, well, in the first place, having sufficient funds to set yourself up to have those resources. So, like, having enough money to grow and having a supplementary income of any sort.
Another question that I have for you is, you had said, like any good cook, artists should ensure that they are seeking the best ingredients they can to craft the best meal. What do you surround yourself with in order to make your best art?
The most important thing is having a community that challenges me as well as supports me. I think that's been the most valuable thing to my practice, is having a creative community that doesn't necessarily produce the same things that I do, but have similar goals, being able to engage with them. So I'm talking about the community I have in person in Kansas.
Is that a community that you've built up personally? How has that community come to happen?
A lot of that community has grown out of the people I surrounded myself with in art school, because I live in Lawrence, which is where I went to school. And a lot of the people I'm talking about I've met through Wonder Fair, which is a really cool space that is a business but also operates in a way that I think is kind of like a nonprofit, where it seeks ways to bring art to the community. Just working with Wonder Fair has been an important part of my creative growth. The other folks that I talk to regularly are people I went to school with. Really, really wonderful that I've been able to hold on to that.
That's huge, I think. Okay, so then second to last thing, because then I have the end of it. But a couple months ago, you held a show that was called A Good Mess, and what I liked about it was that you said you called it a good mess because you feel, quote, that it's a phrase that encapsulates my approach to making things, because the most crucial part is subtraction. It's easy to make a big mess, but identifying and preserving the good parts of the mess is art. How do you go about subtraction to get to the art?
The first part of that is to dive in and make a mess and just commit to it. Like, make as much as you can. Really stick with that as part of the first part of your process. The advice I got from a professor once was to, if you feel stuck, make the ugliest thing you can think of. Make some really terrible art, because after that, you have nothing to be afraid of, because you can only go up from there. That is something I try to do every so often if I feel like I can't make something, because I can make something terrible. Yeah, to start out from having a lot to select from and curate down, like identify one good thing from that mess and to just continue working with that mess until it's something that you feel proud of.
But sometimes you find, because sometimes with subtraction, the tricky piece can be letting go.
Yeah.
And being able to discern between what's necessary and what's unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think definitely being less precious about your work at the beginning. Advice that a lot of people give is don't be so attached to your first few ideas that you don't allow your brain to go other places and make it weird, because that's how you stumble upon ideas that you wouldn't have or would have rejected early on.
In a lot of ways, it's bringing the sense of play and lightness to your work.
Definitely. Like, if you're not having some fun with it or not enjoying the process anymore, then you're wasting your time.
Okay, before I do the last couple parts of the interview, is there anything that I have not asked you that you want to speak to?
I don't think so.
To be able to see Grace's work, to see her wreaths, to see, well, one place to go to see your work is your website, which is gracedchin.com. And then I actually think an even better place, because you're there a lot, and like I said, it's a really thriving community that you have, is on Instagram. And your Instagram handle is just
gracedchin.
Gracedchin. Yeah. So that's a great one, because you showcase a lot of your work there and share what you're making all the time there. The last two things, one is a gratitude. And what I want to appreciate about you is I love this dance between the dark and the light, between the heavy and the light, rather, not so much the dark, but this dance between more feminine, more sweet and strong and provocative. And you do that very much so with your art, like I mentioned, with a wreath, with really pretty flowers, and then right in the middle, some statement that will just wake you up or cause you to stop and pause and think. And then you also do that. I mean, I can just see that's just part of who you are, that you have this demeanor that in some ways feels just very kind and gentle, and yet there's a real strength there and a real conviction. And I really appreciate that you're able to walk both those lines and to weave them together as beautifully as you do.
Thank you so much, Daphne. That's like, that makes my day. And thank you for taking the time to research artists so in depth and to get so familiar with their processes and to highlight their work. It's a really cool thing that not enough people do, and it's really wonderful that you do it.
Oh, thank you, Grace. Well, I have one last thing. So the last question is, why do you think it's important that those people who feel called to create go out and make their thing?
It goes back to that advice that my professor gave. If you have this thing inside you that you want to say, but you don't give the world the chance to hear it, then you're the one who's creating an obstacle between you and the world and your work. There's nothing to lose. If you feel compelled to say something, say it.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much, Grace.
All right. Thank you, Daphne.
I'm Daphne Cohn, and you've been listening to the Creativity Habit Podcast. Head on over to thecreativityhabit.com to read this week's Day in the Life, the rituals and the routines and practices of Macon York Koslow. Macon runs Cotton Blossom Press, a business creating Southern design and letterpress printing. To read about the daily routines and practices of artists and makers, go to thecreativityhabit.com. You can follow The Creativity Habit on Instagram and Facebook. If you haven't yet, go to iTunes Podcast and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. And then join me next week for another Creativity Habit podcast. Thank you for listening.